from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. So obviously the summer has come to a close. It's now the fall season.
Yes.
Nearly Halloween. We did a few shows this summer, Doc, about swimming pools. We talked about the segregated nature of swimming pools.
And basically segregation in all public recreation.
Yes. And then we also talked about the fact that a lot of black people can't swim. Mm-hmm. And the kind of racialized history of that. But I'm like, okay, we got to do one more story about swimming pools because this part was really, really fascinating. Something I had never considered until, of course, I came across this particular article on HuffPost.com. The title of this piece, Doc, is When Swimming as a Muslim Woman Becomes a Political Act. And there's a wonderful series of photos that accompany this article that, anyway, I'm like, we got to talk about it. So yeah. Please welcome to the show today, Rowena Abdelaziz, who is the HuffPost reporter who focuses on Islamophobia and social justice issues within the Muslim community. Rowena, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's a delight. It's a delight to have you. So, you, as I mentioned, you wrote this piece about swimming being a political act for Muslim women. And for the people who cannot see right now the article or see the pictures, why in the world would swimming as a Muslim woman be a political act in this case?
Yes, I think that's an excellent question. And I know you mentioned this and you guys have talked to us on your show multiple times about this concept of swimming and the segregated and racialized history when it comes to swimming in America, right? So we know that this is an issue. We know that this is ingrained in American history when it comes to Black Americans. And so I started looking at this issue when it comes to Muslim Americans and particularly Muslim American women. When we think about Muslim women, right, Muslim women often, many of them, not all of them, tend to cover. They wear the hijab, and that is when they wear a headscarf, right? They cover their hair. They tend to wear long sleeves, long pants, et cetera. And this applies to when they go swimming. It's not just about getting into the water, enjoying the sunshine, and having a good time. It often becomes an instance that is filled with stress and anxiety. Muslim women have been harassed at the pools. They've been kicked out of pools. They face racial slurs, told to, quote unquote, go back to their countries. And so what is supposed to be a leisurely activity becomes this politicized act because their sheer existence as Muslim women who choose to cover then becomes a controversy for what tends to be majority white fellow poolgoers.
Why do you think that this is so controversial, right? I mean, because I just could not believe this story. I was horrified. I felt this is so awful. I can't believe the nerve and the
gall,
and the ignorance of swimmers and pool goers and beach visitors to antagonize and berate Muslim women when they're just trying to enjoy themselves. Like you mentioned in the piece about folks persecuting Muslim women in Minnesota, and also when it comes to incidents in
New Jersey.
In New Jersey and so on and so forth. And even in Delaware, talk to us a bit about what pool goers and beach goers are doing. Are they just yelling? I mean, I know in part of your article you said some people went up to a lifeguard and said, like, get her out and so on. So what are the grounds that they even try to rationalize this racist, violent behavior? What grounds are they even using if they, you know, tell a lifeguard or start berating these women? What are they even saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, because one of the most important things I think that makes this different here in the U.S. and, say, in other countries is that there are no explicit laws or rules that say Muslim women can't swim or Muslim women are not allowed to swim here, right? That's clear-cut discrimination. But what they ended up using is calling their swimwear unhygienic, right? That this is, or it's a safety issue, that these women are going to drown, or their safety to themselves, their safety to other women. And when you begin to peel back at these layers, what it really comes down to is this intersection of xenophobia and misogyny, right? It's policing how Muslim women dress. It's policing what Muslim women do and don't want to wear. Oftentimes when Muslim women are swimming, they're not swimming in jeans. They're not going in sweats. They are going in with what is essentially like a diver suit, right? If you see someone who's diving or surfing out in LA or anywhere else, they're usually covered, long sleeve, long pants. But the material that is made for them is the same exact material you'll find in a swimsuit, in a bikini, in a one-piece or swim shorts, right? And the same thing applies to Muslim women. The clothing that they're wearing, the material, the things that are wearing, it's perfectly safe and is made for swimming. Oftentimes, either A, folks don't know this, right? We have our instance out in the YMCA where Muslim women just talk about, the one Muslim woman I was talking to was just saying, it's a matter of telling these people. She said that every single time I go to the Y or every single time I go to the beach, I have to sit there and put up a whole Muslim one-on-one racism one-on-one Islam one-on-one workshop about why I'm swimming is completely fine, right? So you have the emotional and the mental burden on us as to why this is not unsanitary. And sometimes it is rooted in misogyny and xenophobia and Islamophobia. People want to play God in this instance and say, hey, you are not allowed to swim here because I don't like what you're wearing, right? Or quote unquote, America's a free country, so less is more. This is how we dress here. You know, we don't dress like this. All of that naturally is rooted in discrimination.
Yeah. Describe for our listeners, if you will, a burkini. You mentioned it's similar to a diver suit, but so there's usually three components. Can you describe those components, what it might look like?
Yeah, of course. And I think the most beautiful thing about this and what the photos really encapsulate here is that there's not just one way, right? There's not just one type of bikini.
They're very fashionable.
They're fashionable. And this is just a natural instinct of human rights. People want to look cute. People want to feel comfortable. People just want to swim. And so oftentimes a nice three-piece suit traditionally is leggings. You have like a long tunic that's kind of loose, so it's not super form-fitting. And they're hijab, right?
Yes, yeah.
Sometimes this can be two pieces. It can be three pieces. You have Muslim women who don't even cover their hair and they don't want to wear a hijab, but they want to cover their legs and they want to cover, you know, their tops. And so they choose to swim in that. You know, we had a case of a mother down in the Carolinas who doesn't wear the hijab in the traditional sense. She doesn't cover her hair, but she wanted to dress to her interpretation of modesty. And so she had like wore kind of like capris and a t-shirt, again, swim material. And she was only in the pool just because she had to be in that pool for her kids. She had two young kids with her who were swimming. And she had the police called on her saying what she was wearing was unsanitary. And they unfortunately kicked her out in that instance. Now the YMCA has come out and apologized and said that they're making it clear cut. You have some pools now who are putting in their signs like a silhouette of Muslim women in burkinis. We saw this change in upstate New York this summer. We saw it happen in this particular YMCA. So people can visibly see this is an okay thing. This is an acceptable thing. But a lot of these women are telling me we still got a long way to go before they have to, you know, go through this emotional workshop and tell folks, just leave me alone. I'm just trying to have a good time.
Right. You interviewed in your piece a professor of religion at Northwestern University and author of Pious Fashion, Liz Burkar. And Liz was saying how the professor was articulating that many of the reasons why folks, you know, have some kind of antagonism when it comes to Muslim women has to do with this misconception and the stereotype that Islam is somehow much more patriarchal than other faith groups, and that the burqa or the hijab is actually symbols. These are symbols of that kind of patriarchy. But she argues that folks are changing that, particularly Muslim women. Every day they're changing these misconceptions about their dress and about their culture. Talk to our listeners a bit about how they're going about this. How are they changing these conceptions?
Yeah, I think when people are looking about head coverings or we're talking about modest wear, we're still only thinking about Muslim women, right? We're not thinking about other women in other communities who want to cover, whether that's Jewish women, whether that's Amish women, whether that's women who just want to feel comfortable in their own skin and this is how they want to dress. But because of the stigma that Islam and Muslims have, and I think this is a larger battle that people in the Muslim community are still going through, right? The overall perception, more than like 60-something percent of Americans don't know a Muslim personally, right? And when they don't, they think Islam is evil. They think it's backwards. They think it's oppressive to women. We see this not just because of negative news coverage. We see it in Hollywood. We see it in our TV shows. So all of this contributes to well, if a Christian woman or an Orthodox Jewish woman or just an Amish woman wants to cover, that's because of her religion or her faith or her values, and we can, like, let her be. That's fine. You do you, I do me. But when it comes to Muslim women in particular, there's this concept of we need to save them, right? That they're backwards. They're stuck in 7th century Arabia, and we're in modernized America, and this is how we need to save them and bring them up to the 21st century. And that, by extension, is happening through dress. But now we're seeing a whole new level of different Muslim women who are coming out in different ways and showing essentially them being empowered through their dress. We see that with Halima Aden, right? Halima Aden is an American Muslim Somali fashion model. She made headlines because she was the first model to wear a hijab at her Miss Minnesota USA pageant. She was the first Muslim woman to debut in a burkini on Sports Illustrated, right? The swimsuit edition just this past year. And so when people are seeing these images of empowerment, we're starting to shift that narrative a little bit. And we're also talking about the idea that modest Muslim fashion isn't something that came with, say, your immigrant Muslims, so Muslims that are coming from the Middle East or Muslims that are coming from Southeast Asia, right? The first documented history of modest Muslim fashion started with the Nation of Islam, right, back in the 60s. I talked to another professor, Kayla Wheeler, over at Grand Valley State University, and she's writing a book, actually, that documents Black Muslim fashion in the U.S. specifically. I had an amazing conversation with her where she talked about a lot of the women who were a part of a Nation of Islam were creating small businesses, were entrepreneurs, were making clothes for their friends and their families that were modest, that were long. And this is how this started in the U.S., and yet we're still having this conversation that modesty and covering is somewhat oppressive, and it's not a woman's choice. And at the end of the day, we need to be telling women that they can wear whatever they want. It's not about if they wear more or less. But it's 2019, and here we are having the same conversation. We just have a different minority group that we're targeting this time.
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, I completely agree. I think it's so wonderful and awesome. And then sometimes I think to myself, when folks have gall and nerve and they try to couch it as in some kind of safety or, well, these are the rules, quote unquote. I mean, I find that similar to this, the white women policing Black folk all across the country, you know, like Barbecue Becky and Lemonade Lucy and so on and so forth. I know that it's coming out of racism and certainly policing, feeling like this is your beach or your property or your space and wanting folk who are different from you to get out. But then there's also a part of me that thinks a lot of these Barbecue Beckys and even the folks who are antagonizing these Muslim women while they're swimming are just jealous, right? I mean, we live in a culture in the West that is completely objectifies women, turns them into objects, walking legs, walking breasts, so on and so forth. And I think that, you know, there's a part of them, right, that I think feels envious that these Muslim women are so confident and assured of themselves that they're not here for your objectification. They're not here for your eroticism and your projection of the exotic. I mean, all these kinds of things. And I mean, I think that, I don't know. I think that it's the same with Janelle Monáe when she got all that so controversy, envy, yeah. Like, get off my areola and, like, I'm not here for male for consumption. Yeah, I'm not. And so, I mean, I think that's definitely awesome.
Makes sense to me. But I was thinking, like, with the whole sanitary aspect, Doc, don't try to act like these little kids will be peeing in the pool.
Oh my God.
The people don't be having intercourse. Like, I grew up going
I love to say intercourse.
The free park, public park in the summertime. Yeah. People were wearing condoms in the pool. So my thing is, like, it ain't like pool.
Yo, and especially on a beach and an ocean.
Come on now.
With salt water. And I mean, it just is ridiculous.
Well, I remember one time I went to the YMCA with you when you first started going to the YMCA because you were always going swimming, Doc. And I didn't have, like, swim trunks. I just had, like, some regular, like, cut-off shorts. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like, you know, you can't get in with those. You know, it's like, okay, what is your vested interest?
Yeah, especially you can't get in a chlorine saturated pool.
Yeah,
with something from your house. Yeah. Okay, I don't get that.
Well, sir, you lifeguard, sir, probably pee in the pool your dad on soap because you don't want to. You know, but it's like, so I don't buy the whole hygienic argument. But I wanted to ask you, so as popularity of burkinis grow, is it becoming easier for folk to access these kind of clothing? Because I think once upon a time, folk had to go to overseas websites, but is it becoming more accessible with American manufacturers and American retailers?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, before people were, you had to go to these Muslim majority countries, right? And if you weren't going, if you had a friend that was going out to Turkey, was going to Morocco, you were like, yo, can you cop me out one? Because you just couldn't find it here, right? And if you were looking for something here, it was really hard. This is before Amazon, or you were kind of piecing together maybe a shirt you found here, leggings you found there. And so it was a little bit more difficult back then. But now we've seen different companies. Modenisa is a Turkish company still, but ships to the U.S. It's the one that Halima Aden wore. They said that their burkini sales have increased over 80%, 80% since the last year alone, which is wild. And they are selling to people not just in the U.S., but in Germany and France and Jordan. You have different places that are here in the U.S. Some of them are just have been not looking at it from, say, a modest fashion industry, but from about when it comes to avoiding skin damage, right? And sun damage and protecting your skin. And so that we have one from a Coolie Bar, which is actually based out in Minnesota, and they specialize in sun-safe apparel, right? And they just recently, they noticed that they were getting, a lot of Muslim women were buying from them because, again, they were long sleeves, long pants. And so they specifically launched a swim hijab, which is a line of modest swimwear. They now include the hijab themselves. It's another popular one among Muslim women. And again, some Muslim women are just going up to like Amazon and eBay and putting together things that they want, because it's not just about meeting their religious requirements. Again, these women, they want to look cute. They want colors. They want patterns. I talked to Muslim women who are just like, they want plus sizes, right? Yes. They want to feel good. And that's at the end, I think, the story is trying to tap into this concept of, we all want to enjoy ourselves. We all want to feel good. We all have the human right to do so. But if you're going to have, just because someone is from a particular background or of a certain identity, and you're going to politicize that and weaponize it against them, then this becomes a pattern and a theme that's just extraordinarily upsetting.
So you interviewed Posia Abdullahi about the fact that she's a Black woman, about the fact that she was a Muslim, and her hyper-awareness within living in a Trump kind of world and climate, and how wearing her hijab was a form of resistance and it was a political act. But she also talked to you about how it was a form of joy. Talk to our listeners a bit about your time with her and how a political act can also be a political act as resistance can also be an act of joy, and how joy is political.
Yeah. So when it comes to Posia, what I think was amazing for her, and she was telling me, she is a Black mom. She's a mom of four kids. And she talked about, when it came to her personally, she had kind of given up swimming for a while. It was a hassle. She felt like it was stressful. Anytime she went out, she had to think about the intersections of her identity, right? She was Black. She was Muslim. She wore a hijab. She's a mom. She's got to look out for her kids. So after a while, she said, you know what? I don't need to go swimming. I'm fine just the way I am. But seeing her kids, of course, saw the water and their local pool and going to the beach, and they decided that they wanted to swim, and they had begged her for it. And she really thought about it, and she said, I didn't want to prevent my kids from the joy of water, from sitting in the sunshine and having a good time because of my anxieties. So she talks a lot about the courage and the strength that she had to kind of bring to herself for the sake of her children. And I think there were a lot of moms. I talked to over 30 Muslim women across the country in various different states from various backgrounds. And the ones that were moms really, I think, wanted to push this point to me, where it becomes, this isn't about me, right? This is greater than me. This is for my kids and for the folks who didn't have kids. When I talked to Manar in particular, she had this quote that I absolutely loved. And she said, I kept my hijab on as a form of resistance. That's not always easy. If I'm going to truly commit to this resistance, I have to not just do it for the revolution. I have to do it for my own joy. Mm-hmm. And I deserve that. And that really hit me when we were talking. We were sitting outside of an ice cream shop that was right outside, that was right on the shore. She had her burkini on. We were about to go swimming afterwards. And I felt that. I definitely felt that when she was just saying, every single day I go out and it seems like I'm fighting a war. I'm proving to other people that I'm human. I'm trying to humanize myself. I'm trying to not deal with the misogyny that comes my way, the Islamophobia that comes my way. But sometimes I just want to let my guard down, right? Like, yes, I'm here to fight the good fight, but I also just want to enjoy my life. I just don't want to think about all the possible negative assaults in the text that I'm going through. And she just wanted that. And to think that society had put up all these barriers and these obstacles that she couldn't just deserve her own joy, I think is a notion that so many Muslim women have talked to, and even by extension, so many minority women, right? Not just Muslim women, but any woman that is fighting for her right and for her voice to be heard, just to live her day-to-day life, to be not afraid, I think is something that we can all relate to. And I feel like we need to discuss more of, because what's worse than fighting for your own humanity for you to prove to people that you're just a human? I think yeah. that's an exhausting battle. It's an exhausting battle.
Hey, man. Well, I'll tell you what, Rowena, it's been a delight to have you. Listen, our guest has been a reporter for Huffington Post, Rowena Abdelaziz. She writes a lot about issues focused on Islamophobia and social justice issues within Muslim communities. Rowena, how can our listeners follow you? I mean, I looked at your Twitter feed. It was popping with all kinds of information about, you know, things that are really relevant to Muslim communities. How can our listeners follow you on your social media? And, keep up with your work.
Yeah, you can at me on Twitter at @Rowena_Abdel, A-B-D-E-L. I'm on Facebook, but like you said, I like to keep my Twitter lit, like to get into lots of Twitter fights with Nazi trolls, so all that fun stuff there.
Well, listen, it's been a delight to have you. Please take care and come back anytime.
Thank you so much for having me. Great talk to you both.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh,
or made you think,
we hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
That's donate.strangefruitpod.org.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
So listeners, November is National Inspirational Role Models Month. So all month long, we're going to be sharing some friends and listeners of the show speaking about inspirational role models in their life. According to a website, it says, no matter your age, gender, or stage in life, having someone who inspires you to be the best version of yourself is always a positive thing. Perhaps it's a friend, a celebrity, or an activist. Whether the person is high profile or not isn't important. Their character and ability to inspire, guide, and teach carries much more value. This month, focus on the person who motivates you and thank them for their leadership. So, Doc, our first person up this month is a student of yours.
Yes.
Do you want to introduce them?
Yes, it's my student, Finn DePriest. Isn't that name over?
I love it. Yes.
I love that
name.
Like
a celebrity, like someone I've gone on to one
of. I live for Finn. I live for Finn. Finn has been one of the smartest, most critically thinking students that I've ever had the pleasure of teaching. I enjoy Finn in every single class that Finn's ever taken with me. And so I'm so glad you've joined us today, Finn.
Welcome to the show, Finn. So I put up the call on my Facebook page for folks to share their inspirational role models. And Finn, you mentioned your high school English teacher, Ms. Karen G. Slaff?
Scalf.
Ms. Scalf. Yes. Tell us about Ms. Scalf.
Ms. Scalf was my English teacher my freshman and my senior year of high school. And she was the only out queer person that I knew of in the whole city of Ashland. So whenever I was struggling with my identity, she was a person that I went to.
Tell us a little bit about Ashland. What, were you born there? Were you raised there? What's that town like, especially for queer and trans folk?
Yeah, I moved to Ashland when I was 14. It was my seventh grade year. And I thought it was going to be different because I was moving from like a town that had a very small population in the middle of Ohio, in the middle of nowhere. So I was, like, excited because I was like, okay, city, it's going to be different. It was not. Ashland is where Kim Davis is, the county over from us. She was the marriage clerk who refused to sell marriage or give marriage licenses to queer couples. Gina Haspel is from there. So it's not a very progressive place. So, yeah, living there kind of, I internalized all that homophobia.
Talk to us about the first moment that you meet this teacher and find out that they are queer.
Okay, yeah. I meet this teacher my first day of my freshman year of high school. And she just comes in and she's talking about how she's getting ready to go and get married to her wife because the Supreme Court just passed the Marriage Equality Act. So that was the first time that I met. She talked about the first day of class.
How did you feel? Did you let out a squeal? Did you, like, have an internal dialogue? Like, what?
Yeah, had already come into yourself in terms of knowing who you were, who you probably were going to be before you meet her, And so when she says, you know, I'm about to marry my wife, were you like excited because you were like, yes, someone like in my community or?
Yeah, definitely. I was definitely excited when she announced that because, I mean, I haven't come out to anyone yet. I've known that I was some form of queer since I was like a little child. But I never told anyone. But whenever she said that, I was kind of like, okay, other people like me exist.
Oh, so you felt seen by her.
Yes.
And validated by her. Yes. I love it. I love it. So is this the same teacher that you had told me about who introduced you to the L word?
Yes. Yeah. I house it for her after I graduated. And she was going on vacation over the summer. And so I house it. And she was like, here's Netflix, here's the L word, watch this show. And I watched it, like, all in that weekend.
I love it. I love it. So for this month, you know, we're asked to think about inspirational role models. Just talk a bit about if you could deliver this teacher a message and let her know, you know, in one or two sentences or 30-minute seconds, what she means to you, especially now that you're older and you reflect back. What do you want this teacher to know as you think about this inspirational role models month?
Well, I guess just that, like, I don't feel like I would have ever come to be as, like, proud and out and, like, loud I am about my identities without her because, like, growing up in Ashland and, like, living there, you're just, like, silenced all the time and you're told that, you know, you're not supposed to feel this way, so you shouldn't be this way and you're just, like, constantly, like, ostracized. So I think she was kind of the spark for me to become so, like, radical about my identities.
Is it important to you as you are a student activist and you're active at U of L, is it important to you to be that person for someone else behind you that one day in a year, 5 years, 10 years, someone will talk about Finn DePriest as their inspirational role model? What degree do you feel an obligation to make room for somebody else like she made room for you?
I would love that. I feel like that's one of my, like, things that I want to do. I don't care about, like, money or all that stuff. I just want people to be able to be, like, they help me become who I am.
Yeah, I love it.
I love it.
Well, Finn, thank you so much for being with us. Any last words?
No.
Okay, cool.
Thank you,
my friend.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know what, Doc? We are out of time.
Out of time.
We got to go. We got to do it again next week. But for now, we are out of time. Say goodbye to the people.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koja Tashiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.